Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is behind the rash of municipal bankruptcies, which could lead to a crippling debt crisis at the state and local level where most Americans receive their essential services. Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, joins us to discuss this growing crisis and what to do about it. He has an article with Thomas Ferguson at the Los Angeles Times, Municipal Bankruptcy, The Lessons of California. Then we'll examine the world of hidden money and the extent to which Mitt Romney has used offshore tax havens to shelter some of his money. James Henry, an economist and investigative journalist who was the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company and is the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited, joins us. Then finally, as floods ravage the nuclear-armed but impoverished and food-deficient North Korea, we will be joined in the studio by Blaine Harden, the author of a new book, Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West, a story that sheds new light on the repressive conditions inside the hermit kingdom of the godlike new boy leader Kim Jong-un, which is about the only person in the North Korean born in a North Korean labor camp to have escaped and survived. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and previously was a Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and was the Chief Economist of the United States Banking Committee and the Chief Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. He has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times with Thomas Ferguson, Municipal Bankruptcy, The Lessons of California. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be there.
And the conditions that have struck California and Michigan, Illinois, Alabama, New Jersey, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island, I take it there's a great likelihood that these will spread and essentially these municipalities will be facing the kind of crippling debt crisis which we're seeing at the state and local level. And, of course, the point being that this is where most Americans receive their essential services. When's the wake-up call going to happen? When they've closed our libraries, here in California, you've got to queue up forever, or days, in fact, to get your day in court. What's the breaking point, do you think?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the systemic problems are very severe. Let's start with the politics. The Republican Party depends upon churches as a means of creating civic engagement, field activity, and the public employees unions have always been a stronghold of the Democratic Party, teachers unions, municipal workers, and the like. So at the level of the federal government, the desire is to kind of look the other way, because about 32 cents on every dollar of state and local budgets come from the federal government. So they're starving the state and local budgets, who do not have the same kind of deficit financing capacity as the federal government, and then forcing cutbacks, forcing layoffs, and forcing a breakdown of what you might call the strength or the vitality of these local unions, and that's part of their strategy. It's a Republican versus Democratic strategy. And the Democrats, in particular the president, have not stood up to, stem this tide, because they're primarily worried about deficit reduction and who gets blamed at the national or federal level. So the process of federal dysfunction is propagating into the states, and it's not just California, it's not just Michigan, it's all 50 states. But when things roll up on the beach, certain states have particular problems, and what I wrote about today was California.
So I could see that it's a win-win for the Republicans to defund, to get rid of state employees and their unions, which we saw in Wisconsin, and then to effectively defund the Democratic Party. Now, the stimulus, the original stimulus, had a lot of money in for states and municipalities, particularly
That's
for
right.
states.
Delayed the onset of this.
They delayed. So they must have seen this ticking time bomb. I mean, why
everybody
not?
Everybody was afraid. When we were going over the waterfall, because the financial sector was bringing everybody down, everyone, Democrat, Republican, said, essentially, save the system first, and then we'll go back to fighting about, you know, who gets what piece of the pie. But in the first round, Obama was able, because of fear, to generate a broad support system. And that was true all around the world. That was true in the UK and other places that are also engaged in austerity right now.
Well, Rob Johnson, I just did a piece yesterday on Senator Harkin's report that just came out on the for-profit colleges. It's not entirely related, but it is in a way. The fact that this is a massive, massive ripoff, a venal and cruel ripoff where young minority kids and particularly vets under the GI Bill are conned into student loans at these for-profit colleges, which are largely fraudulent. They end up with crippled by debt and with a worthless diploma. And this is all done on the taxpayer dime. So
it really is. And what's problematic is not just that the for-profit colleges exist, or in the case, which we can talk about in California, the for-profit prisons exist, or the prison guards unions exist. It's that these private lobbies, because of the importance of money in politics, are able to capture capture the outcomes. What the famous economist Mansur Olson wrote a famous book, Logic of Collective Action. And the punchline of the book was, the concentrated interests beat the diffuse common good every time, systematically. And this is a manifestation of that. You have lobbyists in the criminal justice arena looking for more, what you might call, tight conditions for arrests, more people being put in jail, and people serving longer sentences because it's good for their business. In the realm of the for-profit colleges, they want to be able to have free access to the credit markets, and obviously they get paid, and the debtor is the student who is aspiring to the American dream and to climb up the ladder and improve their own lives. So it's a very hard and it's a very cruel system, and it's a very dysfunctional system.
But what gets me, though, Rob Johnson, is that this $32 billion of taxpayer money that's essentially being stolen, at the same time, the storied University of California system is going into bankruptcy, and the people that are really being hit hard in the state of California are the community colleges. These are where kids don't get ripped off, and those aspiring to the middle class can actually get an education. So
that's where people who are forced to retool because of the dynamism in the economy makes their skills obsolete. The community colleges are the place, are the focus. I grew up in Michigan. The entire constellation of county community college was how people augmented their skills and how people retrained themselves. And they are being, how would I say, systematically, they are withering under this budget regime.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He, along with Thomas Ferguson, have an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, Municipal Bankruptcy, The Lessons of California. So I guess it's the politics, as you mentioned, because Spencer Baucus, who's chair of the Finance Committee in the House of Representatives,
Financial Services Committee. Your language is more precise than mine.
Okay. Well, he is famous for trading on inside information that he got during the TARP meltdown when at the time when the Secretary Paulson was on his knees begging Nancy Pelosi to save Wall Street. This guy was doing insider trading on extraordinarily valuable proprietary information that only he and a handful of people had from these extremely high-level important meetings. The guy, believe it or not, was re-elected in his area, which is Birmingham, Alabama. And guess what? Birmingham, Alabama has gone into Chapter 9. I mean, because of its relationship to Wall Street. So I'm wondering...
Well, it is obviously the case that many senators who have big campaign budgets are taking big money from places like money center banks or nuclear power companies or what have you, and doing harm to the constituents in their state so that they build enough war chest to be able to engage in television marketing to win their re-election. It's really quite a tragedy. The dysfunction in the American Congress is horrific and bipartisan.
But where the constituents are involved, why do the constituents vote against their own interest? Is this an information deficit in both in terms of economic literacy and political literacy?
Well, I would say that's an element of it. And the other thing, you have a wonderful professor in Southern California, Antonio Damasio,
sure,
who's written a book called Descartes' Error. He's written many books, but Descartes' Error, which is really about how emotion rather than rationality, I'm going to my INET hat right now, the Institute for New Economic Thinking. Damasio makes a very persuasive case that emotional manipulation, repetition, breadth of repetition, meaning multiple voices, is more convincing than logic, truth, and facts in many contexts. And that when he talks about Descartes, the founder of the Enlightenment, he says that's the wrong model of how the human mind works. And people who are, how would I say, trying to get ahead in the realm of politics have mastered these media techniques. The kind of things you watch on Mad Men on television are applied to politics. As you and I have discussed offline, Ian, our friend Adam Curtis at the BBC's wonderful four-part series, The Century of the Self, lays out over and over how these techniques have been successful in politics, and they're successful now. So part of it's education, and it's part of it is what I will call emotional vulnerability to various techniques. And the population has to arm itself. It has to inoculate itself against all of these methods.
So returning to your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times with Thomas Ferguson, Municipal Bankruptcy, The Lessons of California, Robert Johnson, the state, of course, has been dysfunctional for some time because of the supermajority requirements with both the budgets and taxes or revenues. The state of California is one of three that is uniquely crippled by both requirements. There was a legislative attempt to overturn it. The supermajority, of course, comes from the South, from the Jim Crow South. It was imported here by Jarvis in the Proposition 13, and it's led to this peculiar undemocratic situation in this predominantly blue state, California, where effectively the minority, the Republicans, have ruled through minority power as a result of these restrictions. When the majority gets elected, the first thing they have to go do in Sacramento is go to the minority and say, what can we get done? It's an insane system. So
yes.
What's your you've got a prescription here in your article for what can be done to stop the bleeding and to stop these municipalities and states from crashing, where, again, the point being that most of us get most of our services at that level.
Well, what I would say is at the beginning, one has to stop the same Wall Street firms that caused the crisis, that are causing one-third of the state and local budgets to be victims of a downturn and deficit cutting in a slump, which is taking place all over the world. Those same Wall Street firms that caused that, which are causing the kind of core problem, are the same people who masked the problems by working with municipalities, including, as you mentioned, Spencer Baucus, Alabama, and providing all kinds of derivative instruments, synthetic concoctions in the financial market that are designed to play games. For instance, a governor has an election coming up, and he can't make his budget. So he takes revenues for the next 5 years and brings them forward in a derivative security. So he's essentially borrowing from the future for the present so that he can mask his budget deficit, not make the tough decisions. of course, he's leaving you a bill right after his election is over. And the Wall Street firms make enormous fees from this, and they make enormous windfalls when states are forced to sell through asset sales the public sector-owned, which you might call productive enterprises, you know, water utilities and various other things, and they have to sell them in distress. And if they get certain campaign contributions, certain governors and what have you, like in Wisconsin, will sell very important power plants for, you know, 10, 15 cents on the dollar rather than full value, because they don't represent the taxpayers. They represent what Occupy Wall Street called the 1% who can pay the campaign contributions. This is very demoralizing and very destructive. And the kind of transparency that Paul Volcker and Richard Ravitch created in their report on state and local finances. And in California, you had a representative on that committee, David Crane, who I know quite well, did an excellent job of expressing the fault lines in California, as well as looking at the other states. This is a huge, huge problem. And we have to put, as they say, sunlight is the best disinfectant. We have to bring this stuff up to the level where these are real problems, tangible, like what you might call point-of-sale problems. This is where the services rubber meets the road. And we need transparent systems. We need to challenge politicians. We need to stop financiers from making money providing disguises.
So this study by the former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker and former New York Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch, that presumably has gotten to the desk of the California Governor Jerry Brown.
I can't imagine that it hasn't. I can't verify that for you. But they did six states in the preliminary study, and some of them are more healthy than others, Virginia and Texas. Illinois, New York, and California were among the others. We're having much deeper difficulties. They hope to spread this method and system, which illuminates things and properly accounts for things, to all 50 states, because what's propagating down from the federal government in this prolonged crisis is devastating the basic infrastructure that we all need. And roads and education and other things are always at the tip of the iceberg. Those are, as I mentioned, Professor Olson before, those are the common collective goods, and the common good is beaten by the special interests.
But
in California, you have your particular difficulties related to Prop 13. You have your particular difficulties related to the prison guards union, which is, how would I say, very effective vis-a-vis both the Democrat and Republican Party and insulating themselves from the cutbacks. And the more people who can protect themselves means on the end of the whip are basic, basic services. The New York Times has just had a vivid story about Stockton, California, and the breakdown in law enforcement there. I've watched segments recently in Chicago where Rahm Emanuel has resorted to Minister Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam to maintain order in the streets because he doesn't have an adequate police force any longer because their budgets are being cut. Illinois is one of the states that may be in worse shape than California.
So there is a way then to stop, because the first things to go are the libraries, the colleges, public health, and people really start to notice it when police and fire are
right,
reduced. So you're saying that the writing's on the wall here. And I guess just in closing, what's your final message to both the public and
there's a broad final message that this is a national crisis that has to be attended to. But let me zoom in, because there's one particular thing that really sticks in my craw. There are a lot of people who spent their entire career providing public services, and pensions were negotiated a long time ago. And some of the people using propagandistic techniques are acting like we don't have to honor those pensions, like somehow after the fact we can say they were excessive. Now, politicians may not have put enough money aside to provision for those pensions, and the problems with low interest rates relating to the Wall Street crisis and the financial crisis may make it hard to sustain the earnings. And if you want, because of these problems, you can recontract in the future. But the American people do owe the people who have spent their lives in municipal governments providing them services. They owe them to honor these pensions. They cannot default on these pensions. That is unethical. It is inappropriate, and these people didn't cause them any problems. These people were not excessive. The politicians may have been excessive, but right now we got to clean it up. And that might mean you have to pay more taxes, but you've got to honor contracts. And that's not a left-wing thing. That's not a right-wing thing. That's just basic justice.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Johnson.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz. And previously, Robert Johnson was a Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was the Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Chief Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. He has an article in Tuesday's Los Angeles Times with Thomas Ferguson, Municipal Bankruptcy, The Lessons of California. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with James Henry about his new study that he'd done for the Tax Justice Network, The Price of Offshore Revisited.
Save the money, just say what it used to be. Man, how we used to tear apart this town. Put a dollar into the machine and you'll remember how. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car, I'll tax the street. If you drive to six,
I'll tax your seat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well, thanks, James. And your article a couple of weeks ago, Mitt Romney, the Artful Dodger at Forbes, it looks as though Mitt Romney is trying to successfully dodge the debate about his taxes and how much money he hid offshore. And do you think that he's going to get away with it? He seems like he's laid down a marker that I'm simply not going to talk about this anymore. And do you think he's going to be successful?
Well, I think it depends on how many hard questions people ask him and whether they keep up the demand. You know, there's no explanation for why he isn't revealing these returns. It's virtually unprecedented. He's only released the 2010 return, and that was, of course, prepared after he decided to run. And there's a lot of speculation about what he could possibly be hiding. You know, the IRS had a program for, in the wake of the UBS bank investigation in 2009, the IRS initiated a amnesty program for people who came in and wanted to voluntarily clean up their mistakes in the past. So there's some speculation that he may have been one of the people who enrolled in that program between March 2009 and October of 2009. We just don't know. You know, and the key point is that this would be the first time in U.S. Election history for a presidential candidate not to share with the public at least a half dozen or so of his tax returns.
Well, but he's shared 23 years of his tax returns with John McCain when he was a possible vice presidential pick for McCain.
But at that point, we didn't have the 2009 return. That was 2008. The interesting thing I'm suggesting is that there's something in the 2009 return that's caused him to draw a line.
I see. So the fact that Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate leader, has come out and said that he got a call from somebody, an investor in Bain, who said that Romney didn't pay taxes for 10 years. Is that, I mean, obviously he's obviously very partisan, Reid. But on the other hand, he's not exactly reckless. So do you think he has something?
Well, I have no idea. You know, let's just put it to him. And I think, again, we shouldn't exaggerate the partisan issue here. I mean, organization I work with is not, you know, affiliated with any political party. We are an independent organization that's just interested in cleaning up tax havens. And
that's the Tax Justice Network, right?
That's the Tax Justice Network. So, you know, and there are plenty of wealthy Democrats and hedge fund operators who contribute to the Democratic Party who are also making use of offshore havens to shelter income. This is not really a partisan political issue. Both parties have tolerated the growth of this industry over the last 30 years. The banks that play a major role in taking money for wealthy people around the world and putting in havens tax-free, you know, don't really discriminate between Republicans and Democrats. They have a lot of political influence in both parties. So this is really not, I think, just a Republican versus Democrat issue.
Well, but James Henry, again, an economist, lawyer, investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. And he was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. Now, the price of offshore revisited was $21 trillion. That's $21 trillion as far as I can tell, essentially unproductive money that is equivalent almost what, it's not quite twice our national debt, but there's also, I think in your report, the indication was that it could be as high as $32 trillion, which would be twice the national debt, right?
Yeah. It's bigger than a bread box. I mean, we were shocked to find this number, but we were pretty careful about trying to use three different estimation methods to arrive at this. It's kind of like estimating the size of a black hole because there's no direct light that you can cast on it that doesn't disappear. So we looked at one method was to look at the assets under management and deposits and custodial assets like brokerage accounts at the top 50 players in the international private banking market. And that added up to about $12.3 trillion. A second method was to look at how much unrecorded capital flows out of low and middle income countries, and we were able to build detailed economic models of those flows for 139 developing countries. Oddly enough, there's actually more data available from the IMF and the World Bank on developing countries with respect to capital flight than there is on rich countries. To get a global total, we also looked at the Bank for International Settlements data that it has on cross-border deposits by individuals. And that showed about $7 trillion just of bank deposits as of the end of 2010. So that's, you know, that's only a fraction of the total portfolio that investors would have. And you could scale that up to the global total using the fact that deposits are typically just 20 to 25% of the total portfolio. So the developing countries analysis showed that developing countries accounted for about a third of this 21 to 32 trillion, about $7 to $9 trillion. The banks alone had 12.3 trillion, and the BIS numbers showed that it was the global total was at least 21 trillion. That's in the scheme of things, about 10 to 15% of global wealth, which is on the order of $200 to $220 trillion. But most of it accrues to the very top of the world wealth distribution. So it really does show that we've been understating inequality. We have about 10 million people on the planet, 0.14% of the population, that owns about 80% of the offshore assets and about 33%, a whole third of total financial wealth.
So only the banks know what's going on? I mean, I have noticed, because most of my beat is national security issues, and we know, for example, from back in the Yugoslav wars, when Clinton was in power, that Milosevic, who was the former central banker of Yugoslavia, when it split up, and he basically stole the treasury and parked it in Cyprus and a bunch of other banks. And apparently the National Security Agency, the eavesdropping people, have some facility or ability to track some of this money. And I don't know whether they froze it, but I understand that there was some economic warfare that went on and that goes on, you know, it is a weapon. In other words, it doesn't make any sense to invade a country and kill a bunch of people who are subject to some crooked dictator who's stolen them blind. It makes more sense to, if you can't take out the dictator, then at least take his money away, you know? So I believe...
Well, I assume our intelligence agencies are, sort of up to speed on a lot of this stuff. They're not sharing it with the rest of us, but... You know, when I took a look at the Marcos dynasty in the Philippines, he was in power from 72 to 86. And after he left, I went to the Philippines and looked at what had happened. In his case, he had used the Central Bank of the Philippines as a piggy bank, borrowed about $7 billion in the name of the Central Bank of the Philippines, debt that the Philippines is still servicing. The New York banks involved basically looked the other way as he transferred at least half of that money to Swiss banks. So, that was an example of dictator money. There's dozens of examples like that from Saddam Hussein and the Basha in Nigeria and, Dos Santos in Angola and, you mentioned Milosevic. But the problem is that these kleptocrats basically have a kind of impunity. So, we knew full well that, for example, Mubarak in Egypt had accumulated billions of dollars offshore. Gaddafi had $100 billion offshore under his own family control. These huge sums that are basically ripped off from the country and are sitting in Western investments. But it wasn't considered to be in U.S. interest to expose this while these people were in power.
So is there a name and shame regime? In other words, until you get the information, you can't really name and shame. Is that the problem?
Well, we've done a lot of naming and shaming. I think I've been, involved in writing about this for 30 years. I think it's only now that we are beginning to get a kind of public outrage at this. There's a certain sense in which the public regards this as kind of, with resignation. What do we do about it? I mean, here's another dictator and another outrageous. There's just case after case that you can look through the literature over the last 30 years and find these extreme examples. And then the regular tax evasion that's been exploding, even while we've been cutting taxes, is going along side by side. It's probably in the aggregate much larger. So I think what we need to do is to stop making this such a sensational story necessarily, but also just look at the institutions that support it. Look at the banks, the law firms, the big accounting firms that are basically enabling all this activity, because none of the, there's a certain amount of grow your own kind of offshore evasion, but most of these people who are investing heavy amounts of money offshore, $30 million or more, this is about 100,000, we calculate, people with that kind of income or wealth that they're sheltering offshore. They're not setting up their own offshore tax haven regimes. They're not setting up their own asset protection trusts or their shell structure. They're hiring very sophisticated banks and law firms to do this.
But isn't that the point, that these wealthy individuals, along with big Fortune 500 corporations, are essentially in bed with criminals in the sense that they're both in the same kind of financial whorehouse?
Yeah, I would, I've kind of been reluctant to brand these people as criminal associates. However, you see an example recently of HSBC, you know, the third bank on our list, a major UK bank, just did a deferred prosecution agreement with the Justice Department, in which they admitted that they had been laundering money for the Colombian and Mexican cartels to the tune of $14 billion. You had Wells Fargo exposed running money exchanges in Mexico and helping the Mexican cartel launder billions and billions of dollars. Citibank exposed is doing the same thing. So, yes, it seems that there's certainly a lot of recidivism in this industry. And people have proposed just making an example of one of them. HSBC recently got off with a parking ticket of a $1 billion fine. That sounds like a lot, but their profits are $20 billion. And so the notion of, you know, treating them kind of like we treated BCCI in the 1990s, a Pakistani bank that was thoroughly corrupt and engaged in all kinds of chicanery, we basically put them out of business. There's a case for making an example of one of these major banks or one or more of these major banks because they don't seem to learn from history.
Well, but the point that I was trying to make is that is it a fact that, and we've just in the last minute here, is it a fact that the fact that because prominent and wealthy individuals and big corporations are using these offshore facilities, that's the reason why you can't just go out after these criminals? Are the people who want to go after the criminals who have stolen all this money hamstrung by the fact that the money, in effect, is commingled with the so-called legitimate wealthy people and legitimate Fortune 500 companies?
They're all swimming in the same pond. And, the banks are spending, you know, between 1990 and 2006, the financial services industry in the United States spent $6.8 billion on lobbying campaign contributions in Washington. That's an average of $2,200 per day per congressman. So, yes, they've bought a lot of influence with that, and that's why when you look at the tax codes for the U.S. and the U.K. and Switzerland, they really are designed to attract foreign capital and, not to report it, not to tax it, to get it here and then not tell the source countries anything about it. Meanwhile, we're going after the Swiss, you know, for coming to the United States and targeting wealthy U.S. investors, but we have this double standard when it comes
sure.
to developing countries. But you're right that there's this institutional framework,
right,
basically for which the big banks are the systems operators, and it's not these little havens around the planet. There's about 80 of them, but they're just conduits.
You know, sure.
Final destinations are the great big banks.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, James Henry.
You're quite welcome.
Again, James Henry is an economist and investigative journalist and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and the Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. He was the lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's recent report, The Price of Offshore Revisited. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about North Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us in the studio is Blaine Harden, a contributor to The Economist and a reporter for PBS's Frontline. He has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia, East Europe, and Africa, and is the author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia. And his latest book just out is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Blaine Harden.
Good to be here.
And this is a remarkable story. And of course, it is so hard to understand what happened to this person growing up in the camp, being born into slavery with his parents, who were mother, of course, was later hanged along with his brother, who was executed. The brutality is incomprehensible. And when you contrast that to the adulation of the sort of boy king in this peculiar, paradoxical communist dynasty, it is just, as I say, it is incomprehensible.
It's very hard to get your head around the idea that there's this young leader and his attractive, modern-looking wife running, controlling in an absolute way, a place that continues to enslave its political enemies in camps that it denies exist.
So is the compact similar to the one, for example, in Syria, where the Assads are the family that believe that they have a divine right to run the country, and if as long as you go along with them and don't object, you can live your life in safety. But the minute you raise any minor objection, you're dead. I mean, it seems to me that there's nothing quite as systemic as the kind of repression in North Korea, because there is this godlike adulation. So I suppose if you don't go along with the program, you are by definition a heretic.
That's true. But there are sort of degrees of repression. And compare North Korea to any other state, Syria included, I think is to give North Korea too much of a break. In Syria, it's possible, before the uprising, to make a living, to eat, no matter who you were. In North Korea, a third of the population is always hungry. There have been World Food Program and UNICEF nutrition surveys over the past 15, 20 years, since the big famine in the mid-90s. And they show that a third of the population is not only hungry, but stunted, and a significant percentage of children are impaired intellectually because of childhood malnutrition. And this is an ongoing crisis. And the people who are hungry are those who are out of favor politically. The farther you get away from Pyongyang, the capital, towards the periphery, the hungrier people are, and they've been sent there because they're not perceived to be loyal. So that is one great human rights atrocity for its own people, not to mention the camps. In the camps, that's where they send people who are perceived to be outspoken enemies or related to outspoken enemies, and the camps perform a sort of classic totalitarian function, is they isolate and eliminate perceived enemies, and they scare the hell out of everybody else in the country and keep the country quiet.
So is starvation then a policy? Because obviously if you keep a third of your people weak, starved, preoccupied with trying to find food, they're not exactly fomenting revolution, are they?
To a certain extent, one would have to conclude that it's a policy. For many years, the technocrats in the North Korean government have been talking to technocrats in South Korea about industrialization along a Chinese model. Kim Jong-il resisted it. Attempts to widen economic activity along that Chinese capitalist idea just didn't go through. He was very suspicious of it. He saw that wealth that he didn't control to be dissidents and didn't permit it. And because of that, wealth did not grow. And there's just not enough money in the country to import the food they need. And they can't grow their food because it's a country mostly of rocks and mountains. So one could only conclude that hunger is a policy choice made by those who are not hungry and who are in control and want to stay in control.
Again, I'm speaking with Blaine Harden, a contributor to The Economist and reporter for PBS's Frontline. He formerly served as the Washington Post's bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa, and is the author of the new book, Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. Let's turn to Shin, this extraordinary survivor, because the conditions into which he was born, in which he grew up, and from which he finally escaped are pretty much incomprehensible to, I think, anybody in the West. And I take it you must, I mean, it's an inspiring story of just the human capacity to suffer and survive. And what about the last stage? Give us a sense of where he's at now.
Well, where he's at now is in a much, much better place than when I met him in December 2008 and started working on the reporting for the book. Now he is doing webcasting, living in Seoul. He has really enjoyed the success of the book in as much that he feels validated. He knows that there's an audience in the United States and around the world. The book's been published in 19 languages now, that have paid attention to his story and understood what he went through and what hundreds of thousands of people are still going through in these five big camps that remain. So he's very much encouraged by that. At the same time, he feels guilt that they're still in the camps, and he's out enjoying a life where he does have food to eat and clothes to wear.
So how does he deal with the denial in South Korea? Because this is one of the extraordinary things about trying to get a handle on North Korea is that a lot of South Koreans, because they grew up under a kind of military dictatorship, are very suspicious of their own government. It was only until the North Koreans recently shelled that island, and it was seen live on television, a lot of South Koreans finally realized that maybe there's something really to the propaganda they've been hearing.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that most South Koreans are aware of what North Korea is and how it operates. And that's been the case for many decades. They're pretty cognizant of the brutality and the kind of place it is. But they're also incredibly bored by it. It's a place that goes nowhere. It's the 14th century. It's the past, and they're really looking towards the future in a way that almost no country in the world is. To understand South Korea, you have to know how obsessed it is with success. Right now, according to the OECD statistics, people work more, sleep less, spend more time on the internet, spend more money on cram courses to learn English, and kill themselves at the highest rate of any developed country in the world. They are absolutely obsessed with progress, narrowly defined as the right job, the right university, the right income, the right house, and the right car. And what that has to do with Kim Jong-un and the creaky old dictatorship is virtually nothing. And so they tend not to pay real close attention. When they're shelling, when the North Koreans sink a ship, they talk about it, but they just get on with progress.
But, well, I just recall at the time of the sinking of the warship, there was still a substantial amount of suspicion and people were giving the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I'm just talking to the South Korean left or something.
Well, the South Korean left is active. It does exist, but it's not where the sort of the majority opinion of the country. Most people realize that North Korea was involved in sinking that ship, but they also realize that engaging North Korea in a conflict or an escalation of tension that could lead to conflict is a place they don't want to go. They have so much more to lose than the North Koreans
right.
do.
So what about then this idea that the familial ties are so deep, that the head of Hyundai keeps trying to reach out all the time, and he created the tourism industry, which basically became a big subsidy for the North until they shot some poor tourist, and now they're even talking about renewing that, some sacred mountains or something. What about that kind of familial tie? Is that still very real? Although they must be getting elderly, most of the people.
Yeah. With each passing year, those ties become more attenuated. The people who know their relatives across the border are in their 60s and 70s, or they're dead. And the interest that young people have in paying for unification, a bill that would run into the trillions, according to the estimates that South Korean government has done, they're not very interested in doing it. They're interested in the idea of doing it, but they want to postpone it for a good long time.
Well, tell me then, Blaine Hardin, how does Shin feel then? You just told us that this incredibly successful South Korea, at the end of the day, it's more people commit suicide than anywhere else. So you have this bizarre comparison between a successful country driven by tremendous urges to learn English and become successful, et cetera, and so manic to the point that a lot of people commit suicide. Contrast that to a country where people are starving and being brutalized by an insane regime. It's hard to believe that there's only a little border between the two of them, isn't it?
Well, it's quite a militarized border, as a matter of fact. But there are now between 20, 24,000 North Koreans living in South Korea. These are defectors who've come in the past 12, 14 years. Before then, there were none. And they come to South Korea, and they have a devil of a time finding purchase, finding a way to make a living and just understand what their role is in life. They really struggle. And Shin, because he's special, because he's unique, has gotten attention, and his story has made him a kind of public figure. And now, because he's doing webcasting, he often sits in a studio like we're sitting with another defector, and they talk about what life was like in North Korea and how hard it is for both of them to find a way forward living in South Korea. So he's found sort of a meaning in what he's doing. He struggled mightily in South Korea when he first got there. And now, because there are so many North Koreans there, he has found a reason to live and a profession going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Blaine Hardin, the author of Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. So conversely, my understanding is that the Achilles heel of the North Korean regime is the extent to which the bubble is slowly being burst that people live in by bootleg copies of South Korean soap operas that are available in the black market in North Korea. And in fact, the authorities, in trying to stamp it out, apparently cut off the power in various areas so that the VCRs get jammed in the machines and then they arrest these poor people. So we've got a sense of the cultural disconnect from those that flee the North and try to deal with the materialism in the South. What about the materialism of the South being the Achilles heel of the regime in the North?
Well, I think the story of what's going on in the North in terms of the information that they're beginning to absorb or have been absorbing for the past decade is probably the most important change, along with the scruffy street markets where most people buy their food and their goods. What's happened with North Korea is that the totalitarian system has remained in control, but two fundamental things have changed. Information control has really, really eroded. Part of it is all the small Chinese electronics that have come across this semi-permeable border between the North and China. And so now it's possible for a very large number of people to listen to radio. The United States government and South Korea have funded an enormous radio operation. So if you have the vaguest of radios, you can receive, you're bombarded with counter-regime propaganda. The U.S. government recently released a report showing that a very significant percentage of the population listens regularly to this radio. So they know what's going on, and they see the DVDs and the CDs that come across the border with the soaps from South Korea. I talked to a young guy who said he learned about the United States from watching knockoffs of Charlie's Angels and from James Bond movies. And that's been going on for a decade. And that's changed the intellectual reality of life in North Korea. People know that they're living in a hellhole, and they know that every place else is better off. And the North Korean government, in fact, knows that they know, and they try to spin it in this way, that the reason you're suffering, the reason you're hungry, the reason there's no electricity, is because of those evil Americans and the puppet regime in South Korea. Mm-hmm. So they've tried to do that, but still people are unhappy, and they're beginning to understand how deep a hole they're in. And that's new. And the second thing is the regime's ability to deliver food. Before the Soviet Union collapsed, North Korea could sell shoddy goods to the Soviets and get money and cheap fuel and fuel fertilizer. That game ended, there was a massive famine, and now the way the economy works is people trade stuff that they've smuggled across the border from China.
So the country now is beset by floods. Recently, there was stories in the South Korean press that the North, the new leader who hasn't been given a mantle of either being the great leader or the dear leader yet, as far as I know, has he?
They call him the young general.
The young general.
That's the term that came out, and I think it still sort of sticks. But supreme leader now and marshal.
Well, apparently the North Koreans scoffed at the idea that there'd be any reforms. He's supposed to be the young general who hasn't served a day in the military. He's supposed to be heading to China. So give us a sense of what China gets out of this. I can understand what the Chinese don't want the regime to totally collapse and to have essentially the U.S. Army back on the Yellow River. I can understand that. But what is the glue that holds China and North Korea together?
Well, I think that buffer is part of it. Part of it is they do not want a chaotic collapse of the state with sort of an uncontrolled flow of people of North Koreans across that border. The border between China and North Korea is not exactly a border between Chinese people and Korean people. There are a lot of ethnic Korean people on the Chinese side of that border, millions. And controlling that border and keeping a puppet regime, or at least a regime that they feel that is a kind of puppet, is much more comforting to them in terms of their own population. And then there's also there are valuable minerals in North Korea, $1 trillion worth of iron ore, molybdenum, other things that China needs for its aerospace industry, and that it is exploiting now. And then there is the question of having a U.S. allied Korean Peninsula on its border. So all those things, I think. But one other thing is that in my reporting with South Korean people who are South Korean technocrats and bureaucrats who are dealing with China and North Korea on a business level, they think that China very much wants to slowly open up North Korea to its style of communism and to lower the temperatures in terms of the missiles and nuclear threat so that goes away. And so it's sort of business as usual and as dealing with Southeast Asia, with Burma or with Vietnam. That's the kind of model I think that a lot of bureaucrats, technocrats in Beijing would like to see.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West, Blaine Hardin.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Blaine Hardin, a contributor to The Economist and a reporter for PBS's Frontline. He has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa, and is the author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia. And his latest book just out is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manners. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.